This week's Torah portion for the 30,000-foot view that I like to give so that if you went to shul on Friday or Saturday, you would kind of vaguely know what was coming up. This week's Torah portion is Parshat Shoftim. Parshat Shoftim is Deuteronomy 16 through 20. And there's a number of interesting things here. The back end of the Torah portion deals with cutting down trees and whether you're permitted to cut down trees during the siege of an enemy city, which is a really interesting thing, and kind of the general concept of what happens when you besiege a city. The front end deals with a couple of issues, the most important of which is the opening line and the few lines that follow it, which is Shoftim v'shotrim titen lecha b'kol she'arecha asher Adonai Elohecha noten lecha lishvatecha v'shaftu et ha'am mishpat tzedek. You shall appoint magistrates and officials for your tribe, in all the settlements, gates that the Lord your God has given you, and they shall govern the people with due justice. So that is an interesting translation, which we'll pull apart because there's a bunch of words in here that don't necessarily translate exactly this way. So Shoftim is definitely judges. Shotrim we're less clear about. The general assumption is that a Shofet is a judge, meaning a person who deals with a legal issue after an individual has been brought to justice. Many people believe that Shotrim are kind of the middleman in the justice process, right? We would call them today policemen. But in 1000 before the Common Era, there was no such concept. So these were kind of like magistrates or officials, right? People who were responsible for carrying out justice. So, and then it says, Titan lecha b'kol she'arecha, place in all your gates would be a literal translation. And then it says, that which your Lord, the Lord God has given you, give to you to your tribes. So I'm being very literal here. The text goes on. I'm not giving a very good 30,000-foot view. I'm giving a micro view. But the text goes on to talk about the concept of jurisprudence and the concept of justice. And the famous line from this week's Torah portion is tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. Justice, justice shall you pursue. And so this whole area is dealing with the question of what makes justice just, right? Your judges should not favor the rich nor the poor, the powerful nor the weak. A justice or a judge should not take a bribe. And justice should be equally accessible for everyone and be applied equally for everyone. And then there's this phrase that shows up at the end of this verse, which is this concept of mishpat tzedek. Here it's translated as due justice. Mishpat is generally understood as justice, and tzedek is known as righteousness, and which is problematic for us English speakers because they're kind of synonyms, right? Being righteous and doing justice are often kind of interchangeably used. And that's a problem that Torah also has too. Mishpat and tzedek are kind of juxtaposed as two synonymic words. But the commentators, because Torah would never waste a synonym, it would never use the same kind of word twice without each word having specific meaning. So our medieval commentators and our Talmudic commentators are interested in pulling apart what makes for mishpat and what makes for tzedek, what makes for justice and what makes for righteousness, which is, Marilyn, your favorite concept. The idea of really trying to get the specific meaning of a word and trying to pull that out of it. Like, what is righteousness versus justice? And how does using the phrase righteous justice advance our cause of understanding of either one of those terms? Okay? All right. That's where we're at. We get four nifty commentaries. Our first commentary is from a guy by the name of Likutei Yehuda. A guy I don't think we've ever seen before. His name is Rabbi Yehuda Aryeh Leibel Heine. Never heard of him before. And I don't know much else about him other than the fact that he's fairly contemporary. He would have been the modern generation of Hasidim, died in 1954. Okay. So he makes a nifty move. He says, why does the text put together Parshat Shoftim with the section, Parasha, of the festivals, which is at the end of the previous Parasha? So to explain that line by itself, last week's Torah portion ended in a strange place. It ended with the laws of what are called the Maaser Sheni. The Maaser Sheni was an offering that every individual had to bring at the three festival offerings. And in the, I always have to remember this, the first, the second, the fourth, and the fifth year of Maaser Sheni, the offering goes to the Levites. And it's like a calf or a chicken or something like that. And in the third and the sixth year, the offering goes to the poor. It becomes Matanot Le'Avyonim. And then in the seventh year, it's a sabbatical year. There is no offering at all because the land is lying fallow. You couldn't harvest grain, crops, or animals at all. So why do we have this thing about the festival offering and feasting at the festivals in Jerusalem in front of the temple? And then we move right from that into this line about justices and judges, right? There is nothing, for the commentators, there is nothing random about Torah. The fact that one law is next to another law in Torah is not because it's a long rambling text full of laws that get chucked into a bin. They have meaning. The placing of one next to another must have some sort of reason. So our commentator continues. Because the section of the festivals also includes the mitzvah of tzedakah, the commandment of giving charity, that one needs to rejoice with the ger. Ger here means probably the convert, the orphan, and the widow. It can also mean stranger. So one has an obligation to rejoice with the ger, the orphan, and the widow. Behold, everywhere that the text mentions righteousness, it also mentions justice. To keep the way of the Lord by doing what is just and right. So it's giving examples. That's Genesis 18, the story of Abraham at Sodom and Gomorrah, my favorite. And so too, we get another verse. You who worked righteous judgment in Jacob, Psalm 99. This is because in a place where there is no justice, there is a fear that the property came to them by way of theft, the robbing of the poor, and the groaning of the beggars. And in this way, righteousness would not be considered meaningful of anything, since the property would have come into their hand by way of a transgression. Therefore, there is a need for righteousness and justice to be together. And so it is that the intention to mention here the matter of righteousness, and also to remind of the matter of justice. So you may not have caught that. There was a subtle move, and I just kind of kept talking. So he's moving together the term tzedakah and the word mishpat. So there's a slight change that happened right there, right? The original Hebrew says tzedek u'mishpat, righteousness and justice. And he's talking about tzedakah, which is charity, like charitable giving, and justice. He's kind of throwing out the question, what if a person could justify the ends with the means in giving tzedakah? And by that I mean the Robin Hood scenario, right? What if a person could say, there are poor people in the world, and I need to feed and clothe and take care of them. Therefore, I will become a pirate, or I will rob banks, or I will steal from the king, or I will embezzle money from this Fortune 500 company, right? The ends cannot justify the means. Is the takeaway from this. A thing that I think we generally take for granted, but the concept of chassidut is the concept of gut checking yourself in regards to your own behavior and action on a regular basis, right? Do my ends justify my means? You know, the concept that a poor person who is hungry might be okay for them to steal bread is one that is challenged by this text. Right? So we're getting into an important philosophical area. And that important philosophical area is, are there righteous acts that have to come through by ignoble gains, by improper behavior? The classic paradigmatic version of this, in which there is a tshuva in the conservative movement, and there is a kind of morally questionable school. Actually, now at this point, there are multiple morally questionable schools. When I was young, this is not that long ago, but about 25 years ago, the Jewish day school in Los Angeles, California, the Jewish high school in Los Angeles, California, acquired a major donor. And the major donor gave all this money. And then shortly thereafter, he was indicted for fraud and embezzlement. And that Jewish school is called Milken, Milken Community Day School. The question is out there and has always been out there. So Michael Milken, in order to acquire a lot of money, did some legal things and did some things that the Justice Department later decided were illegal, which were basically junk bonds. And the criminality of junk bonds is not that you float a financial device that is lousy. You can float a lousy financial device whenever you want, supposedly. It's pretending that it's probably more stable than it is. And that's the part at which Milken got into trouble, because that's fraud. So the question becomes, can you put your name on a Jewish institution if the money to that Jewish institution by which the name was acquired happens with fraud? Some of those same questions might be applied to the Adelson School in Las Vegas, which is only about 10 years old. It's a K through 8. And some of you are laughing because you think I'm going to get political. I'm not. Sheldon Adelson's not guilty of a crime, per se. Sheldon Adelson's questionable moral aspects in regards to tzedakah have to do with the fact that most of his money is made through gambling. And gambling is generally frowned upon in the Jewish world, not because it's illegal, but because it's immodest, right? It would be not – if to be very blunt, if Larry Flint was Jewish and wanted to found a Jewish school, I don't know how the Jewish community would feel by that. Adelson is a similar situation, a questionable moral activity that results in a wonderful donation of goods. I'll give one final example, although this one kind of solved itself. I was part of the Hartman cohort of Jewish educators. The Shalom Hartman Institute in Israel was a major beneficiary of one major benefactor. And I was in this three-year educational cohort. And in the end of year two, they wrote to us and said, it does not look like we can afford to bring you guys back to Israel for year three because our major benefactor just got popped because he was the purveyor of a massive Ponzi scheme in America. And his name was Bernie Madoff. Bernie Madoff was one of the major donors to a number of Jewish institutions. Again, that one solved itself because the money dried up, because the money didn't really belong to the Hartman Institute. The money had been forwarded on from part of the Ponzi scheme. It was legitimately somebody else's investment, which they thought they were putting into the stock market, but was actually taken from person A to give to person B, and then give to person C, and then give to person D, and then give to the Hartman Institute, and then give to Rabbi Goodman's airline ticket. So I am the benefactor of ill-gotten gain. Some of my rabbinic education comes from that. So anyhow, my long-winded point being, you got to be careful. You know, you got to be careful to see where the money comes from. It shouldn't be beyond reproach. You're not expected to be extremely, you know, careful about every single donor. But nonetheless, like when you know something comes from a bad place, you have to kind of stop and say, like, how is this going to reflect on us? What does it mean? And the ends don't justify the means. Okay. We're going to move on from there and go to the next text. We'll open it up for kind of comment after this one so that anybody who has some other thoughts can jump in. Our next text, same verse. It uses what's called the Dibor HaMachil, the pivot text, the opening, the entire verse. Judges and justices you shall place before you in all your gates. And it continues. By way of what? Oh, let me figure out who this. Oh, this is the Chatam Sofer. Chatam Sofer is a fairly modern guy. He would not be generally considered a Hasid. I let non-Hasidic texts slide in here every once in a while because I'm an equal opportunity rabbi. And also, the book that I'm writing based on these texts is not actually strictly Hasidic. It falls into all of the categories: Hasidic, Mitnagdish, which is the kind of counter-Hasidic group, and then somewhere in the middle is a group called Musar. Musar is ethical kind of flagellistic is the word I'm thinking of, but it's not a real word. Ascetic is the word. Self-abusing kind of school of Judaism, that you should be the Zen Buddhist version of Judaism, where you should suffer in order to understand God and Judaism better. So Chatam Sofer fits into the Misnagdish world. He was fairly anti-Hasidic, very halachic, extremely Lithuanian, and very strict in his kind of barons and his understanding and observance. Okay, and he says this. By way of what the sages say in the Midrash, on the verse, I will betroth you with righteousness and justice and with goodness and with mercy, that the Holy One, Blessed Be, provides chesed, kindness, and rachamim, compassion, and we provide righteousness and justice. Okay, that's really important just to start off understanding. So our commentator starts in a really neat place. He starts by quoting a verse that for those of us who put on tefillin every morning, we know very, very well. There are three things we say when we put on tefillin. There's a blessing you say when you put on the arm tefillin. There's another blessing you say when you put on the head tefillin. And then before you finish wrapping around your arm and when you're done with the head, you wrap around your hand. And when you wrap around your hand, you wrap around your finger. And when you wrap around your finger, you say, Verastich li b'tzedek u'b'mishpat u'b'chesed u'b'rachamim, which appears right here in our text. It's a quote from the book of Hosea. And it says, I will betroth you to me in righteousness, in justice, in mercy, and in loving kindness, or loving kindness and mercy. So the move that our rabbi is doing here, the Chatam Sofer, is why these four things together? And by parenthetically, why those two things together? Why are tzedek and mishpat in the same verse? And why are tzedek, mishpat, chesed, and rachamim in the same verse? Why have justice and mercy and righteousness, justice and mercy and righteousness and loving kindness? I kind of threw those all together. But they're big concepts within Judaism. They're big divine aspects. They're big human aspects, right? How do our lives juxtapose and balance those four forces at hopefully an equal amount? And his answer is fascinating. His answer is God, the Holy One, Blessed Be, gives two, and we give the other two, okay? So God is the purveyor in the universe of kindness and compassion. And it is our responsibility to bring down the justice and the righteousness. That's a very interesting perspective that we learn our, because it's, by the way, it fits in neatly with the biography I gave of him of being kind of strict and rigid, right? His understanding is we ought to be strict and rigid because God is going to be the merciful one. Or, moreover, another way of understanding this that's completely different, human beings are inherently strict and rigid. God is what opens us up to being kind and merciful. So we must learn kindness and mercy and not adhere too much to strictness and righteousness only. That's, by the way, the concept of righteousness in juxtaposition to the term self-righteousness is kind of related here, right? We learn mercy and kindness so that we do not become self-righteous. Okay, we're going to continue by kind of hoping that he fleshes this out a little bit more. And he says the following. And in this manner, we establish the covenant of an engagement between the two sides. And here, in this text, God pours out for us with God's abundant compassion and for the earth much kindness, right? So he goes another layer deeper, which is to say, why throw out both words chesed and rachamim? Why have mercy and loving kindness? And the answer he gives is one is individual, it's for us, and another is for all the earth. He says aretz, all of the land. And so kindness applies to the earth, and compassion, mercy, is for the individual. And God gave us great cities and houses full of goodness. And thus it is upon us to bring righteousness and justice into our nation. So that's interesting, right? And I think this one can be relatable on a political or on a national scale, both for America and for Israel. God creates a universe in which we can all feed each other. God creates a universe in which we could, if we chose so, provide medical care for everyone in the world. God makes this a reality, right? God creates the ability to build buildings that all of us could dwell within. God creates the capability in society for enough clothing to be manufactured that no one should go cold and naked. And it is upon us to bring righteousness and justice into our nation. It's up to us to find justice and righteousness enough to balance all of those things so that everybody has enough, so that there is a fair and equal distribution of things. Also, that there is a fair and equal distribution of law, and that cuts across all of the different individuals that exist in our world today. Gay and straight, trans and cis, black and white, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Buddhist, catch-all, right? The concept being like God provides for all human beings. I think if we're taking the Chatam Sofer at his most broadest, we can understand this to believe that, you know, a major rebuke to the concept of Jews as a chosen people being better or special or elevated is that there are a lot of people who are not Jewish and have millions of dollars and fancy cars and do really well in life. Or people who are not Jewish and are spiritually and morally enlightened, like a person like Thich Nhat Hanh or Father Martin or Dr. Martin Luther King, like a number of individuals in the world who I would read their religious texts and feel enlightened, and they are not Jewish texts, right? God creates all these people, and it is up to us to try and find equanimity, balance, and fairness amongst all these different types. All right, let's finish it off. Chatam Sofer says, "And in this verse you shall appoint magistrates and officials for your tribes in all your settlements," expresses the kindness and compassion of God. And also that you do your part. He literally, it's very literal. He says, "Vegama ta titen et chelkecha," right? You do your part. I can't translate it any better than that. You judge the people with righteous justice, right? Your human, God gives everything into the world. You got to be fair. Do your part. Be fair. And I think that speaks really nicely to our current situation in America right now of trying to find fairness and justice in a time which is full of mess. All right, that's a good one. Any kind of, I'll open that one up if anyone has any kind of deeper thoughts or reflections on this section. Anyone want to kind of throw in? Oh, Shirley joined us. Hi, Shirley. Good. Any other thoughts on this text? It's a neat one, right? Good. All right, we'll go to the next one, which is our topic for today, like how to shut out negative influences. That's the sound I make when I'm trying to find the screen. The da-da-da-da-da. You all heard the da-da-da-da-da. All right. We're on to a dude who's called the Shelah. He's very cool. So in the Hebrew here, it says Shin Lamed He. Shin Lamed He is an acronym for the Shnei Luchot HaBrit, which is the expression in the Torah for the two tablets of the law. So every rabbi wrote a book, and they stopped calling themselves Rabbi Mark Asher Goodman. They start to call themselves by the title of their work. Now, I have the working title for my book right now, which is through chapter 33, is Life Lessons from Recently Dead Rabbis. That's a very long acronym for me, the LLFRDR. But it could be that later on you will say, I was a student of the LLFRDR, the Lefferder, because that's literally how this guy is known. He's known as the Shelah. So the Shnei Luchot HaBrit was a guy by the name of Rabbi Yeshayahu ben Avram Horowitz. He is interesting in that he is pre-Hasidic, but he's in that really neat time period after most of Kabbalistic literature has been written, but before the Hasidim are popularizing it. So he's kind of a vaguely obscure rabbi that not a lot of people would know or study, because he falls into this period in Jewish history that is not medieval, not Kabbalistic, or not like the main Kabbalistic period of the 13th to the 15th century. And he's pre-Hasidic, so pretty wild. And he does a fairly weird move. His weird move is this. He looks at the first couple words of this verse and then drops the rest. He says, Shoftim v'shotrim titen lecha b'kol she'arecha. You shall appoint magistrates and officials in all your gates. Now, what would all your gates mean if we don't live in gated cities anymore? He's going to make a move to the word gates, meaning orifices of the human body. Pretty weird, but stay with me. Okay, he says, there are seven gates to the soul. And he quotes a book called the Sefer Yetzirah, the Book of Creation. The Sefer Yetzirah is, I think, 12th century. Maybe it's 5th century. I don't recall. You can Google it later and correct me. The Sefer Yetzirah is one of the first Kabbalistic works, explicitly Kabbalistic works. It is literally called the Book of Creation. It is a very weird book about how God created the cosmos and the physical processes that God makes. I have read parts of the Sefer Yetzirah. It is absolute, complete, mind-blowing nonsense if you are trying to read it and understand it literally. It's just very weird, right? Seven Gates to the Soul is a really good introduction to how strange it is, because it talks a lot about God's physical features, which it also simultaneously will say, we all know that God doesn't have physical features. So it's like, and then it'll say, and God's nose is this long. And you're like, didn't you just say God doesn't have a nose? I don't know what's going on here. So it speaks in strange Kabbalistic metaphor that is supposed to not be taken literally while it speaks of it literally. I can't explain it any better than that because, to be honest, I find the Sefer Yetzirah very difficult to understand. Only with help of guys like the Shela could I even attempt to understand the Sefer Yetzirah. Okay, he continues. Seven gates to the soul, right? The gates are the two ears, the two eyes, the two nostrils, and the mouth, right? So how do we have gates to the soul? It's basically our senses, our four senses. So you smell, you see, you taste, and you hear, right? Whose ways are to pass the external impressions into the midst of the person. Another way of saying this is, how do we gather information and understanding of our world through our physical comprehension of it? And these are the gates to the soul. Our soul is a tactile soul, right? It experiences things through the four senses. And short of the senses, we don't have a capability of accessing our soul, right? Or our soul delights in the inputs that our physicality creates for it. Our soul's inputs are physical, even though it is a spiritual being. Fascinating, right? And about this, the verse states, you shall appoint magistrates and officials for your tribes in all the settlements. So pay attention that loathing and profanity doesn't pass by way of these gates. So this is our opening conversation, right? How you guard yourself from the negative influences and the yucky stuff that comes into you. Some of us, it's news. Some of us, it's specific political individuals who say or speak things which are either distrustful or profane or hateful or are cruel. And for others of us, it's finding ways of interacting with individuals in our lives, maybe a coworker or a client who is not a great person to deal with, and finding a way to try and shut off the gates, right? The ears shouldn't hear defamation and profanity. So way back to Rana's comment at the beginning, right? If you are about to hear someone go on a long rant about how evil and wicked a specific group in society is. And you know that it is dishonest and profane and hateful and spiteful. Turn it off, right? So too, and this is a difficult, because it's difficult for me to do. If you're about to hear a comedian who is a George Carlin seven deadly words that you can't say on network television person, you could make the argument that, so the shell is making the argument that maybe you should skip this and go watch Jim Gaffigan. Jim Gaffigan, known as a comedian who works clean, right? He does not swear. Or Jerry Seinfeld, who never, ever, ever swears in his comedy routines and still gets a pretty good laugh. If you're, the ears shouldn't hear defamation and profanity. Now, I am known for swearing on occasion when it's necessary. By the way, the Hebrew term for this is nivul. The broader Hebrew or Jewish concept of profanity is nivul peh. Nivul or nevel is literally translated as carrion or carcasses, right? Nivul peh is translated pretty literally as carcass tongue, right? That roadkill that you see by the side of the road, right? Dropping an F-bomb is comparative in Hebrew to that dead raccoon you passed on I-396 just before, okay? Interesting juxtaposition, right? It's worthy of note of how swearing or any profane word, any hateful, spiteful, negative, evil word has a real effect on the soul, right? I think to think broader about this, racist language or language that can be interpreted as racist, right? The Washington football team just changed their name. You can argue all you want. Well, we've had this team for name for a long time, but it means something different. And you shouldn't take it literally. And oh, you're such a snowflake. Why don't you relax? Language has meaning. And language used repetitively will eventually wear down the soul to the point where you think that profane, hateful, spiteful, negative stuff is okay, and it's okay to treat people that way, and it's okay to think that way. And the reality is, it has an effect. Words harm, words hurt, and so you shouldn't take them lightly. So the ears shouldn't hear them is basically the Shella's argument, right? Just block it out, right? Which is why some newspapers have literally, for years before Washington chose to change their own name, stopped calling them the Redskins, because they were just like, we're not going to print that word in our newspaper. I think the Washington Post wasn't doing it for a couple of years, which is crazy because that was a local throwball team. Anyways, they continue. The eyes shouldn't see evil and the mouth shouldn't speak perverseness. So that's the hardest one for all of us. I think we all get into those moments when we want to talk smack about an individual that we do not like. Maybe a friend or a colleague who sometimes drives us crazy. But we got to figure out how to balance it, right? Because according to this, those orifices are the seven gates of justice, the seven gates to the soul. And we cannot do justice if we are passing through those gates lots of unjust and unrighteous action, right? And that injustice and unrighteousness includes saying yucky things, hearing yucky things, seeing yucky things, right? And that's the Shnei Luchot HaBrit's kind of take, which is to that point that I made at the very, very beginning of like limiting the negative influences in your life. Try and find that point where you find the balance between seeing the negativity that is necessary in order to interact in our world. Right? People have to document bad stuff, right? If you took this too literally, you would say we should never send anyone to be a war correspondent because the eyes shouldn't see evil, right? I don't think he meant that. I think he was more about tempering your exposure to soul-crushing things. Right now I'm reading a book called Five Came Back, which is about the five most famous directors of the 1950s who all went off to World War II. And I just hit the chapter where several of them are at the storming of the beach in Normandy, June 6, 1944. and the two directors who were physically there do not write of it, do not speak of it, and the only one who comments on it doesn't say anything about it for 20 years, right? This is almost emphatically emphasizing my is underscoring my point, which is that toxic influences in your life can be traumatic. And these guys saw the worst of the worst. They saw death and destruction at a ground level, and one never spoke of it again, and the other one only spoke of it 20 years later. I was a kid. I used to ask my grandfather. My grandfather was a corpsman in World War II in the South Pacific. He worked on a hospital ship for 3 years. His job was, when the soldiers got put onto the hospital ship, he was kind of an orderly on the hospital ship. So he saw a lot of bad stuff. And the only reason we know what he saw was we know what ship he worked on, and we know what battles the ship was at. And I say that because he wouldn't tell us anything about what he saw. All you need to know about my grandfather's experience in World War II is that they made him a corpsman in the U.S. Army on a hospital ship because he was pre-med at the University of California at Santa Barbara, and then he joined the Army. And because he was pre-med, they said, well, you should be a corpsman. You can help out medically. And he came back from the war in 1945 and promptly enrolled in accounting school because he never wanted to work with anyone who'd been hospitalized ever again. The eyes shouldn't see evil. Okay, last text for the day. But final thought, God bless those people who see bad stuff and work their way through it. You know, it's really important work to deal with the really tough stuff in society. Our final text for the day is a really interesting one, and it's really nice. It's a good finishing one. It's a little bit bumper stickery. For those of you who are new to my class, the bumper sticker texts are the short, pithy texts which don't require a lot of pulling apart. They also happen to be the ones that I almost inveterately post to Twitter every day, and this one I did post to Twitter about 2 hours ago. So, you shall appoint magistrates and officials for you. So, interestingly enough, one of the fun things with Torah is you can do a lot of fun things with Torah by reading selectively. And one of the fun things with Torah is a commentator is totally permitted to delete any words in a sentence if it makes their point better for them. And so this commentator, the Toldot Yaakov Yosef, who is one of the earliest Hasidic commentators, he is the right-hand man to the Baal Shem Tov, and he wrote down mostly what the Baal Shem Tov said. We're never quite sure what he wrote down that actually belongs to the Baal Shem Tov, the original guy who invented Hasidut. What belongs to the Baal Shem Tov and what belongs to the Toldot Yaakov Yosef himself, we never really know. His real name was Yaakov Yosef of Polonia. Polonia was a town nearby to Meserich. Meserich, the town that Rabbi Yisrael, the Baal Shem Tov, was born and lived in. So his fun move is this. He says, you shall appoint magistrates and officials for you. He just deletes the word in your gates. He deletes the word in your towns. He deletes the word for your tribes. He just says, lecha, to you. And here he keeps going and he translates. Lecha, to you, to yourself, right? So this is cool, right? So for those of us who are not in a position of appointing judges and, you know, maybe it's an off election year and we're not voting for attorney general this year, which we are not in Pittsburgh, for instance. So then what do you do with this verse? And the answer is, instead of the verse meaning specifically about creating a society full of justices and magistrates, create justices and magistrates for yourself. So what are they? Lecha, to you, to yourself. Before you judge yourself, say something nice about yourself. Kodem lekol tishpot et atzmecha, kashut atzmecha tchila. So fun. This is my colleague, Rabbi Mike Werbo, was the guy who translated this text for us. And I love his translation. Kishut is better translated as adorn yourself. Think about like putting on earrings, right? Adorning yourself. Adorn yourself beforehand. But adorn is, you know, is a funny word. Compliment yourself is a much nicer translation that Mike came up with. So it's really interesting, right? Like you're about to kind of say something or think something tough about yourself. Stop. Say something nice about yourself, right? Before you are self-critical, find an aspect to which you are wonderful. I am a thoughtful, caring, loving individual. And also the sermon I wrote for Friday is hot garbage on a stick and it needs revision, right? Before you are tough on yourself, find self-love. It's essential. By the way, this is not some hippy-dippy, you know, squishy 21st century New Age text. This is a 18th century text. Fascinating, right? But he keeps going and he spins it the other way too. So this is a beautiful one because it's got a lot of back and forth. Okay, so be lenient on yourself, love yourself. But also, don't be lenient about yourself and strict with other people, right? Don't judge other people and be like, oh, so-and-so is so lousy and so shiftless and such a jerk and blah, 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 right? Like, how can you be so tough on your coworker and then kind of give yourself, you know, a pause about that time that you yelled at your secretary for jamming the copier, right? Like, you can't do both. You've got to be lenient with your fellow human and lenient with yourself. You can't let things slide with others that you wouldn't let slide. On Sunday, I taught this to the Minyan, and I mentioned that I had a roommate in rabbinical school who I only had for a year, and he was very vain, and he was fairly self-centered, and he took up too much space, and he was a lousy listener. And I really didn't like him, and I did not like those aspects about him. And while I was at my therapist one week, my therapist was the one that really pointed out that the aspects of him that I did not like were the aspects in me that I did not like about myself. My egotism, my vaingloriousness, and my propensity to take up too much space in a room, all of which are characteristics endemic of the rabbinic world, right? We are all very good about talking too much and not listening enough. By the way, this happened and my wife literally walked into the room while everyone else was on the Zoom call before Mariv. My wife just starts nodding. Sick burn my wife gave. All right, anyways, forgive and be lenient with yourself and be sure that with others, you are not splitting hairs and requiring from them what you are not requiring from yourself, right? Judge not, lest ye be judged yourself, those in glass houses. Both of those kind of ideas are exhibited in this text, although the Toldot Yaakov Yosef would literally have never studied the words those in glass houses, since that's from the New Testament, and they don't learn that in Hasidic rabbinic school. He keeps going, Bekol sha'arecha, in all your gates, in all your assessments, and measures of yourself. So not only does he say that shoftim v'shotrim titen lecha, lecha means judge yourself fairly and righteously and compassionately, but he keeps going and he adds one more word, b'kol sha'arecha, all day, every day. He translates b'kol sha'arecha in all your gates as all day, every day, right? Give yourself a break, judge other people, the same way you judge others, and there is no point in your life at which you can say, well, I'm just going to turn this switch off right now, right? Nope, you cannot turn off the self-compassion switch because it's not suitable for right now, right? Do not beat yourself up. And if you're going to beat yourself up, provide yourself with adequate self-love additionally, right? If you're going to be tough on your colleagues, your friends, your family, you need to be equally tough on yourself. So if you think so-and-so is a hypocrite, you must examine for yourself what are the ways in which I might be perceived as a hypocrite as well. Because if you can't judge them the same degree that you judge yourself, then you too are a hypocrite. We've got to find those little gears in ourselves that allow us to be fair, and balanced, because that, I think, is the core of righteousness. By the way, and I'll kind of conclude with this thought, the classic verse that every rabbi teaches this week, we'll see what your rabbi teaches at synagogue this week, is tzedek tzedek tirdof, justice, justice shall you pursue, right? I think it's easy because it's very easy as a society to turn the camera outward and say society's unfair and the legal system's unfair and Black Lives Matter and, you know, we should change this, that, and the other, right? It's very easy for us to tune in to the Democratic National Convention and hope that, you know, if I make the right vote, then that guy on the TV is going to bring the justice. And that don't work. That ain't going to work, right? You must be the change you wish to see in the world, said Gandhi, right? And the change starts right here, right now at home with you. The cool thing about Hasidut is in my younger days as a rabbi, I was very into social justice Torah because social justice Torah is very good at pointing the finger out of the world and saying, you know, Bernie Sanders is got to be elected so that he fixes all these problems with immigration and healthcare, right? No, doesn't work in Hasidut. In Hasidut, the change starts with you. And you have to figure out the ways in which you can make yourself a better human being, a more righteous human being, a more compassionate human being, and how you can then actualize that out into the world. So be the change you wish to see, be compassionate to yourself, and do some justice. All right. If anyone would like to stick around, ask questions or continue kind of the discussion, please stick around. Otherwise, it was great having you guys on board, and we'll be back next week with whatever Parsha comes after Shoftim. I don't remember. Go ahead, Marilyn.
Sorry, I actually have a question for you. And that is that the second to the last one, okay? The one about the seven orifices. part of me sees in that something a little more than what you said, and I'll, let me explain why. When we look out, you know, we take in. When we breathe in, we also breathe out, you know, and it goes both ways. And when I saw the thing about not seeing evil, I didn't read it only as, you know, try to avoid evil situations, but I saw it as don't assume that something is evil when you look at it until you've done both, breathe in and breathe out. You've assessed the situation. I really liked that one, by the way, which is why I'm talking. And I actually saw that it was the metaphor there suggests to us not that we shouldn't see evil, but that it'd be, you know, where and avoid it, that evil, is that we shouldn't see evil unless it's really evil. We need to not just look at somebody and say because of their religion or the color of their skin that they're evil, for example. We shouldn't look at somebody who has a handicap of some form or another, a disability, and see lesser. We need to make sure that what we're really seeing is the evil, or somebody truly lesser or deficient in something for some reason. And I loved, actually, that metaphor that he used because of the way we actually take input in. The only thing it doesn't work with is the ears, because I don't think we put anything out with our ears. But, you know, that's a sense that of the concept of perceiving as well as judging. You know, there, we can see incorrectly. We have to be careful, and that's what judgment does for us. That's why everything has to be in a cycle. And I thought that that was really actually a very interesting one, and I enjoyed it, and I'm still parsing it in my head because it's a fascinating way to look at that.
Yeah, I think you hit on concept, an issue within the text, which is worthy of further exploration, but not today. But I also randomly was doing some filing and reorganizing and went back to look at a text that we actually started the whole year on, which is we did a text at the very, very beginning about the creation of light, and that, you know, that God creates light and dark, and behold, it was good. And one of our commentators asked basically the same question a little bit, which is asking the question, okay, what's good and what's evil? And so the concept of seeing evil is two questions, like two words that are interesting to kind of think about. Like what aspect of what does it mean to see evil? What are we looking at and perceive it? And another question is, what do we call ra, evil? Like what qualifies as bad or evil? And that it shouldn't be, I think you kind of are looking for absolute objective evil as opposed to subjective bad, right? That which is an
there is such a thing as evil in the world.
Yeah.
Okay? But I think far too often we misuse the term evil. And I think that comes from the fact that we don't just see, we take in and we process, and then what happens in the processing goes back out, and that is filtered through who we are as people, which is why we make mistakes sometimes in our judgments. And so, yes, we should know what evil is, and we should by all means never look on it, as in make it worth our gaze. On the other hand, we have to be very careful what we call evil.
Yeah.
We need to understand that we may be maybe picking something up from inside ourselves, or from the way we were raised, or from the environment in which we find ourselves, our particular situation, that let us categorize something as evil that really isn't. And that's this interesting thing about justice and judgment and putting guardians at the gate. There's you're putting up all these safeguards to make sure that you really know what is evil, because then you can respond more effectively, I think. You know, it goes back to the original question, how do you respond? You can't respond until you've assessed, until you've processed, until you've determined to what you're responding and why and to whom and in what circumstance, because otherwise it's kind of like flopping around in the water to save yourself from drowning without really knowing that if you swim, if you move your body, your arms a certain way, you're going to stay afloat. And so I the whole thing just strikes me as very, very interesting and worthy of much more than an hour of our time. But so I don't have anything to say bad about your choices for today.
Thanks. Do you know what? There was no choice in this week. Some weeks, usually when I learn with Rabbi Werbo, we kind of just go. We usually kind of pick a verse that we're interested in, and we do all of those verses. Because we can't skip around, because we can't agree on what to skip to. So this one was a classic where we just kind of started at the beginning and went. And you just got – so to some degree, these are the four choices of the author of this series. I think his name is Rabbi Horowitz. So I forget. Suddenly I desperately want to know who it is. It's Rabbi Aaron Yaakov Grinberg, who the dude must be a genius because he goes through so many sources in order to find these. Renee, you wanted to say something. Go ahead.
Is there a reason why they left out the fifth sense? Because you can touch, you touch fire, you know that hurts. I just can't see why they left it out.
It's great. Right. So the simple answer is what Audrey says, is that it's an orifice, and the riff that the Sefer Yetzirah is using is the word she'arecha, your gates, right? So it has to be an opening to the body. Now, the better another question is, why does the Sefer Yetzirah use those orifices and not any of the other openings that the body has? Because there are a couple more. And the answer is, by the way, the Sefer Yetzirah does talk about the lower orifices, I think, in other places. But there's a general understanding in the Kabbalistic world of the reproductive organs not being kind of placed in the same category as the orifices of the upper body. So I'll give you my favorite little learning that you'll learn about Hasidim from this. If any of you have seen the classic picture or video, or have met in person a Hasid, you'll know that they wear a big furry hat on Shabbat or on Yom Tov, and then they wear a gabardine, a cloak, a what looks like a bathrobe. I don't have a good translation for that. A robe. And one of the aspects of the robe is a rope that is tied around the waist, right? You might think that this is just they're imitating Polish nobility of the 18th and 19th century, and that's why they dress this way, which is one of the reasons for why. There is a reason, a Kabbalistic reason for the girdle, for the belt in the middle. And the reason for the belt is that Kabbalistically, Hasidim believe you should divide the lower part of your body with the upper part of your body. That the lower part is sacred and has all sorts of important sacred roles, but in order to avoid intellectualizing the prurient aspects of our nature, which deal with sexuality and reproduction, you should physically put a belt around it, which is fascinating. It's a spiritual practice which is meant to inculcate a mental practice, which you guys have been learning with me all year. Chassidut is all about trying to change your behavior through reading Torah a specific way, right? The classic one that gets quoted a lot is that a chassid puts on their left shoe and then their right shoe and then ties their right shoe and then ties their left shoe very specifically every morning. And the reason is that you should move from chesed to gevura, that you should move from loving kindness to righteousness and righteousness back to loving kindness in equal balance, and that you should bounce from one to the other, that you should go from the aspects of God that are harsh and judgmental and the ones that are merciful in equal amounts in our lives. It's kind of a crazy attempt to intellectualize every single act that you do, right? For a true chassid, a very punctilious chassid, not like me, there are no meaningless actions in the life. A true chassid cuts the grass on their lawn while thinking about a chassidic text which would reflect well on that grass. Yeah. All right. Great to see you all this week. I hope you guys are good, and I'll see you all next week.
Thank you.
Marilyn, you sound great.
I'm really so much better. It's just that whatever they do when they do the stretching, I left my throat really swollen and sore. I'm about to go have another. The great thing is I get to eat a lot of Italian ice to bring the swelling down. But I haven't, they let me go back on real food yesterday, and I have not choked.